Okay, good morning all. Our first case for argument this morning is the Sierra Club versus Environmental Protection Agency. Mr. Narayan.
May it please the court, I'm Sanjay Narayan representing the petitioner of Sierra Club. These cases challenge EPA's decisions to redesignate three areas, Milwaukee, St. Louis, and Chicago, from non-attainment to attainment under its 1997 ozone standard. To make those redesignations, the Clean Air Act requires not just that air quality improve to meet the standard, but that this improvement be the result of permanent and enforceable measures rather than temporary conditions. That determination is at the heart of these consolidated cases. But before getting to EPA's decision, I want to emphasize why this determination is of critical importance. In this court's 2004 Sierra Club versus EPA decision, this court held that after redesignation, all the state has to do under a standard is whatever worked to achieve attainment and nothing more. This determination right here, where EPA decides these measures were sufficient to produce attainment, this is where EPA decides, and the state decides, that these measures are what worked. And it thereby defines the regulatory regime that will govern ozone under this standard going forward, and it essentially eliminates the possibility that further measures might be required to secure attainment under this standard. And that is why I think, in that 2004 decision, this court described this finding, that attainment be the result of permanent and enforceable measures, as the vital finding for purposes of redesignation. Now, to make that finding here, EPA basically reached three conclusions. First, it said some regulations have been adopted addressing ozone precursors. That's nitrogen oxides and volatile organics. Second, it said that emissions of those precursors, at least in these areas, had gone down after those regulations had been adopted, or at least mostly after those regulations had been adopted. And third, it said that ozone levels in these areas had simultaneously dropped below the standard. Now, as an initial matter, if that's all subsection 3 of 7407D3E requires, then subsection 3 is very close to meaningless. Because under subsection 1 of that provision, we know that ozone has to have fallen below the standard in all of these areas. And under subsection 5, we know that the state has to have met the Act's non-attainment requirements in Part D, which require that there be some regulations that have reduced ozone precursors. So if it's enough to meet subsection 3, that EPA can just say, well, the state's adopted some regulations that have reduced precursors, and ozone has fallen to meet the standard, subsection 3 becomes very, very close to superfluous. And it's very hard to imagine. It's essentially impossible to imagine any situation in which a redesignation request could meet the other parts of this section, 7407D3E, and not also meet the requirements of subsection 3. But that's not, I think, what the subsection requires, either under its text or under EPA's interpretation of what it requires. What's required here is that EPA distinguish between the effects of its regulations, of permanent and enforceable measures, and the effects of temporary conditions, and confirm that the regulatory measures, the permanent and enforceable measures, are sufficient to produce attainment in these areas.
Is that the only way to make the finding? You don't challenge that the finding was made here, the subsection 3 finding.
That's right. EPA reached the conclusion. I think what we're challenging is whether there's anything in the record that rationally supports that conclusion.
But there's more than one way to make the causation finding, I think, is my basic question here.
Yeah, I think there's certainly different ways of making the causation finding, but this way was not sufficient. Because here, rather than distinguish between temporary conditions and regulatory measures, EPA basically assumed that temporary conditions didn't exist, that they were relevant, that they were irrelevant. And we know that's not true. I mean, volatile organics and nitrogen oxides, right, the precursors, those are industrial emissions. And we know that industrial activity is affected by all kinds of things aside from regulations. Importantly, it's affected by underlying economic conditions. And a lot changed between 2005 and 2008 in terms of the economy. So, yes, EPA has ways of, I think many ways, of making a causal finding here. But whatever route it takes, it has to at least consider all of the relevant factors. And if it's ignoring things that we know affect the relationship between regulations and precursors, then it has not made a reasonable finding. And it's not just the relationship between regulations and precursors. We also know that the relationship between ozone precursors, nitrogen oxides and volatile organics, and ozone is not linear and is very complicated. Right? I mean, there's a difference between nitrogen oxides and volatile organics in an area and ozone in an area. We know that weather makes a difference. Importantly, ozone isn't always formed in the same place as the emissions of nitrogen oxides and volatile organics. Usually, it's formed somewhere else, downwind. And finally, it's not even a one-to-one relationship. Sometimes you can have a reduction in nitrogen oxides that causes ozone to go up. Those are the facts in this court's New York versus EPA decision. So there are two leaps here where there are important additional considerations that EPA's analysis here simply fails to take into account. Now, the agency has said, at least in its brief, that it did more here, that it conducted some analysis, or at least it provided some estimates of what its regulations accomplished in these areas. But if you look at the record, I think what you see is that, first of all, it provided those estimates for some regulations, but not for all of them. And for many of these regulations, EPA just said, well, the regulations were adopted. And then where it did provide estimates, it provided only very, very general estimates. These are nationwide estimates, statewide estimates, over a variety of time frames, some while the area was still in non-attainment, some after the area reached attainment. So if you try to link those estimates to the improvement in air quality that we care about here, that is the improvement that occurred between 2005 and 2008, which EPA chose to represent attainment in these areas, there's nothing in those estimates that allows you to figure out what the regulations meant for that particular air quality improvement. That is what they meant in terms of ozone in these areas.
Well, why is it necessary in order to meet the sub 3 standard of causation that the agency link specific aspects of the implementation plan or the federal regulations that to specific reductions in ozone levels? I mean, that seems to be what you're arguing, that there has to be that tidal link between individual aspects of the state implementation plan and federal regulations and specific amounts of reduction in ozone, for lack of a better way to put it. That's how I read your argument, that it can't be a more general link.
No, to be clear, I think it could be more general. I mean, I think this EPA could say, well, collectively, here's what we think the regulations accomplish. But it has to tie the regulations somehow to the air quality improvement we care about here. That is, a reduction in ozone sufficient to meet the standard. It's not enough for EPA just to say, well, we have these regulations and they made some difference. Right? Because if that's all it takes, I mean, if all it takes is there be some regulations that made some difference, then again, subsection 3 doesn't really mean anything, because we know that for any non-attainment area, there's going to be some regulations that make some difference. And secondly, if it's enough that there just be some regulations that make some difference, if you step back and look at the broader structure of the Act, as this court has construed it, right, after redesignation, the state's obligations are to do whatever work to nothing more. And in that 2004 Sierra Club decision, this court pointed to this determination as where EPA decides what worked. It doesn't need to do that afterwards. It doesn't need to do that as part of its maintenance plan. So if EPA doesn't at least draw that connection here, that is draw a connection between the regulations and an improvement in air quality enough, sufficient to meet the standard, then that determination is simply never made. Right? I mean, there's a missing link, and we never have any place in the statute.
I thought the maintenance plans were reevaluated every 5 years by law. Is that not right? I mean, you seem to be suggesting that once there's a redesignation of an area as having moved from non-attainment to attainment, that's sort of the end of the story in terms of regulatory activity. That's hardly the case in this area.
No, it's not. That's right. That's not the case. But, you know, the maintenance plan has provisions in it that I think provide a process by which subsequent problems might be addressed after they arise. But that isn't a substitute for making sure now that there are measures in place to prevent those problems from arising in the first place.
And we actually have significant regulatory activity since the time period's in question here, as I understand it. The basic standard has been altered to be more stringent?
There has been a second standard put in place that is more stringent, the 2008 standard. But EPA has said quite clearly that these are two independent standards that need to be independently met. And here, that standard was in place when the states came forward and sought redesignation here. And the states made clear, I think at page 220 of the record at the public hearing, that they knew that that standard was going to come into effect. And at least St. Louis and Chicago, but not Milwaukee, would face attainment problems there. What they said is that they were interested in putting the 1997 standard to bed. I think that's likely in part because the requirements under the 2008 standard are significantly less stringent for these areas than they are under the 1997 standard. These areas are in moderate non-attainment under the 1997 standard, and they are in marginal non-attainment under the 1997 standard. So there's a real difference in the regulatory requirements that apply. And I think a significant incentive for Illinois, as it said, to put the 1997 standard to bed and begin to make stepwise progress towards getting out of non-attainment entirely. Now, you know, the absence of a link, I think, between the improvement in air quality that we care about here, the improvement sufficient to meet the standard, and the underlying record is, I think, a little bit clearer, actually, if we start at the other end, rather than just start with the regulations and try to work our way up to the ozone improvements, if you start with the ozone improvements and then try to work your way back to the regulations. Because if you do that, you know, the first question is, well, okay, how are these ozone improvements linked to the precursor reductions that EPA has said are sufficient to produce them, that is, these 2008 actual emissions just in the area? And there, I think EPA's answer is pretty clear. It's, well, we didn't think we had to actually develop a relationship between the precursors and ozone in the areas, even though we know that that's a very tricky relationship and that there is much more to ozone in an area than there is than just the amount of nitrogen oxides and volatile organics in the area. Again, often the ozone forms someplace completely different. It forms downwind, and depending on the conditions, you know, you may not get a decrease in ozone just by decreasing nitrogen oxides.
Have you, in your research or in perhaps somewhere in a brief that I missed, pointed to a situation where this ozone, as you would say, tricky business has been addressed in a fashion differently by the EPA, where they have met the metrics that you would suggest are necessary, or is this just another example of what you would say insufficient action by the EPA in analyzing this problem?
There are certainly places in which EPA has very carefully addressed the relationship between ozone precursors and ozone. It's done so, I think, most thoroughly in its actions addressing transport of ozone from one region to another. So if you look at the Supreme Court's recent Homer City decision that addressed this cross-state air pollution rule, which has not yet gone into effect, but presumably will at some point, there you see a very thorough modeling exercise meant to precisely pin down what reductions in volatile organics and nitrogen oxides might mean to ozone levels and where.
So that was an example of better modeling by the EPA?
That's an example of one way in which the EPA can bridge the gap between ozone precursors and ozone.
Is that the way that you would suggest they ought to? I mean, I understand you say there's a failure here.
Right.
But I'm just trying to probe, and if you could help me on what direction they should have gone.
That's what we would like to see, but I don't think that's the only way. I mean, I don't want to say the EPA has to do that. I mean, it's certainly what we would like to see, and I think we would concede that that sort of modeling analysis would be sufficient. But I do want to be clear that the agency does have some discretion as to how it answers these questions, so long as it answers them. So there may be other ways. There may be simpler models. There may be a way of aggregating regulations. It may be able to look at analyses that it's done elsewhere. Right. So long as it bridges that gap somehow. In this record, there's just nothing there.
The only thing that's there is the ozone level is lower.
The
ozone level is lower than it.
Well, the ozone level is lower, but if you actually look at the ozone trends, and these can be found either on page 38 of the record for Milwaukee Racine, page 54 and 71 for Chicago and St. Louis, what you see is that ozone was going steadily up before 2008, drops precipitously in 2008, and then starts going right back up again at almost all of the monitors at almost all of the regions. On top of that, you know, for Milwaukee at least, you know, we have exactly the same regulations and exactly the same analysis applied to two areas, Sheboygan and Milwaukee. Well, in Sheboygan, EPA deploys exactly the same analysis, puts the same regulations into place, and ozone not only rises, but rises to exceed the standard, you know, four times per year for three straight years, such that, you know, what you see is that these regulations have not produced a permanent and enforceable reduction in ozone. And at least to the extent that, you know, one thing EPA is saying here is that it somehow requires some massive feat of speculation to conceive that ozone might increase above the standard under these measures, I think it's relevant that in St. Louis, at least once, ozone has gone above the standard in the area. That's not something EPA could have considered here as part of its decision. It happened afterwards. We accept that. But again, it at least suggests that, you know, we don't have to speculate to say these measures are likely to be insufficient to keep ozone below the levels indefinitely, below the standard indefinitely. Excuse me.
Well, what kind of regulation are you suggesting that there be additional regulations or modification of the regulations to achieve what you're looking for?
Well, I think at least on this record, it's possible that EPA could go back and look at the regulations in place and actually do the analysis and say, well, we think that regulations made enough of a difference here that we will achieve the standard no matter what. That's going to be hard, I think, in St. Louis, but that's one possibility. It could do the analysis and come out in the same place. But I think the other possibility is it might say, well, we had these very low levels in 2008, you know, in the middle of a 75-year recession, right, the worst economic conditions since the Great Depression, and then say, well, but in fact, right, we know that in Milwaukee, power plants are permitted to emit much, much more, six times more than all stationary sources emitted in 2008. What the agency could do is say, well, you know, Wisconsin, if you want to rely on those 2008 levels, what you need to do is put some regulation in place or show us some regulation that requires that those emissions will be sustained over time, right, that those will be permanent and enforceable. Or, I mean, the agency actually has lots of options here. It could say, well, show us some technical constraints that show that those levels really can never be exceeded, that something has changed at these plants that suggested that they're never going to go back to their 2004 levels.
Well, I mean, but you even take into political consideration, say, that the attitude with regard to construction of power generation plants, that's not coal-fired, pretty a dead issue, isn't it?
It might be, but EPA has a procedure for that, which it sets out in the general preamble in which it announces its interpretation of these regulations. If there are major sources of nitrogen oxides, like coal plants, that are shutting down, EPA can absolutely take that into account. It just needs to have it reflected in the implementation plan. Or I think, you know, it may even be able to say, look, that plant's gone. They tore it down. We don't have to worry about that anymore. On this record, though, we don't know anything about any of that. And again, I think it's relevant that regardless of what's happening with coal-fired power plants, you know, in some of these areas, despite these regulations, we're seeing ozone levels go back up again.
Could you take a moment or two on the issue of standing?
Sure. I think there are two ways in which this decision substantially raises the probability, the likelihood, that Sierra Club's members will be subject to additional ozone pollution in the future. The first is, as I mentioned earlier, this decision essentially forecloses the possibility that there will be additional measures added at least over the next 5 years, right? At least before the area lapses back into non-attainment, to keep ozone levels low. I mean, in that Sierra Club versus EPA decision, the 2004 decision, this court basically pointed to this determination, the determination of permanent and enforceable measures, as the place where EPA decides whether or not additional measures are necessary. So by making this decision this way, let me flip it around. If the court were to vacate this decision, the state, if it wanted to redesignate these areas, would have to come back and say, we are going to add more measures to control ozone, or would have to say, well, no, here's precisely why these measures are enough. But either way, I think that's a real change in the likelihood that there will be more measures to control ozone in these areas. And I don't think we need to speculate here to say that the states are going to want to get these areas out of non-attainment. I mean, that's the entire structure of the Act, is to establish incentives so that states will want to move areas from non-attainment to attainment for each of its standards. And again, Illinois has said, you know, despite the 2008 standard, at page 220, it said, you know, we want to put this to bed. We want to put the 1997 standard to bed, even though we know that we're going to have to do more under the 2008 standard. So that's, I think, one significant effect of this decision. The other one is, even if you look in the very, very near term, this decision takes these areas and, instead of having the provisions of a moderate non-attainment area, right, which are set out in Part D of the Act, which involve stringent requirements for construction of any new sources, instead it puts them, if it's Milwaukee, all the way into the attainment regime, into the prevention of significant deterioration regime, which contains much less stringent requirements. And then for Illinois and St. Louis, it moves the areas from moderate non-attainment to marginal non-attainment, which again, even in the very near term, reduces the pollution control requirements applicable in those areas. So you have this near-term change in pollution control requirements. But really, I think it's important to pay attention to the fact that those really function as an incentive to the state to produce the long-term change, which is to come back and seek redesignation with a fully developed record that shows that they have measures in place that are at least sufficient to produce attainment over this 2005 to 2008 period, or whatever time period they change, but they were enough to at least once bring the area from non-attainment to attainment.
That suggests to me it's sort of a negative argument that with a more strict regulatory regime, there would be even better improvement of the ozone in the atmosphere as opposed to simply attainment. More, in other words, it's we have standing because we have a right to have more improvement than the agency has already said exists. Rather than we have, you know, an issue about whether attainment has actually been achieved.
That's right. Our issue is not whether attainment has been achieved, because at least when they submitted these redesignations, it was achieved. So, you know, subsection 1 is met here. This is really about the requirements of subsection 3, which are, well, okay, are there measures in place that prevent air quality from deteriorating
right,
further?
Right, but what's your client's interest in those measures, in that causation finding that you're asking us to overturn?
Well, again, there's two. I mean, one is that all by themselves, these decisions do relax the regulatory requirements applicable in these areas. It moves them from, again, the non-attainment regime with non-attainment new source review into either PSD review or marginal non-attainment review, both of which are less stringent. But on the other front, our members are affected by ozone pollution, and ozone causes harm even where the standard isn't violated, right? I mean, EPA has said that even at lower concentrations, that is below 0.085.
Right, that's what I meant when I said it's sort of a negative argument, that we would be experiencing even cleaner air if this decision is undone, then exists now?
I think it's we would be less likely, or sorry, our members would be less likely to be exposed to harmful ozone pollution if further measures were to be added. Those measures would reduce ozone pollution, yes. This is about the future, so you know, I'm forced to talk in terms of probabilities. But at least here, if the decision stays this way, right, there's zero probability, at least you know, for the next 5 years, right, that in the near term, the state will add anything to these plans. If the court were to send us back, you know, the state will be forced to ask that question, which I think is important. I mean, a case here that is close is the D.C. Circuit's Town of Barnstable decision, right, where the FAA was making a recommendation to the Department of Interior. And yes, it was possible. It was a safety recommendation that Interior would just say, well, we don't care what the FAA thinks, right? But everything we knew, the court knew about the way the process works, suggests that, in fact, that recommendation would make a difference. It would make it materially less likely that Interior would go ahead and approve the project. I think here we can say that it is at least substantially likely that this decision makes a difference as to the regulatory measures that will be included in that attainment plan going forward. And again, even in the very near term, if you want to look at just the immediate consequence of vacature, you know, as soon as the mandate goes into effect, the regime would then move from either marginal non-attainment for St. Louis and Chicago or prevention of significant deterioration for Milwaukee into moderate non-attainment, which contains more stringent requirements.
Okay.
There are no further questions, I'll...
Not at this time. Thank you. Mr. Serino?
May it please the court. My name is Paul Serino. I'm with the United States Department of Justice. I'm joined at council table by Paul Versace of EPA's Office of General Counsel. I'd like to first address the issue of petitioner's lack of standing. The petitioner's not demonstrated an actual injury that is fairly traceable to the redesignation decisions at issue. I'll then turn to the merits arguments. But with regard to standing, I was listening closely to petitioner's counsel describe the nature of the injury that its members would suffer, and he described it as that the redesignation decision substantially raises the possibility of higher ozone levels in the future. And he said the injury was that it was less likely that they would be or more likely to be exposed to ozone pollution in the future. Now, the Supreme Court has spoken to the issue of standing in the Clapper case just in 2013, and the Supreme Court stated, thus we have repeatedly reiterated that threatened injury must be certainly impending to constitute injury in fact, and that allegations of possible future injury are not sufficient. And I would...
Well, how does anybody ever establish standing to challenge a redesignation?
Well, if the members of the organization can assert facts that demonstrate
I mean, it's always a future injury, right?
I don't know about that. I don't want to... Can't think of all the scenarios, but it's a factual showing that has to be made of an injury as a result of a redesignation decision. I'm not saying that's an easy thing to do, but I know it hasn't been done here, especially since the more stringent 2008 standard is in place. So
a separate issue, and I want to talk about that too. But you know, with respect to the basic standing inquiry in a case like this, you know, take the new, more stringent 2008 standard off the table for the moment. Again, the question is how, and maybe nobody can ever establish standing because this is a forward-looking inquiry and the injury is always off in the future and inherently speculative. I think that's your argument. then is it the EPA's position that nobody can ever challenge a redesignation decision?
That's not the position I'm making
have
today.
Have plaintiffs successfully established standing to challenge redesignation decisions elsewhere in the country?
Well, there have been redesignation challenges. Yes, that have. I can't speak to whether they...
All right. Your argument would essentially cut them off.
I would say under these facts, it does.
Well, more categorical than that. Again, taking the 2008, the new standards off the table, the basic argument would cut off any challenge to a redesignation decision because the injury is always in the future and is hard to evaluate.
It is, especially since there's a maintenance plan in place that carries forward the permanent enforceable regulations that led to attainment. And then the maintenance plan contains a contingency plan that gets triggered if there's, you know.
So the regulatory review is all that's required here. There's no judicial review.
Well, I don't think that's
well, that's
right.
The import of the government's position here.
Well, in this case, I think.
Well, not just in this case. I mean, if we were to issue a decision that said no standing, again, separate and apart from the issue of the 2008 standards, which may have an important effect here on the standing inquiry. A decision that the Sierra Club, on behalf of its members, can't challenge a redesignation is a pretty categorical decision.
Well, we haven't advanced that categorical argument, and I don't want to rule out that under a certain factual showing that it's possible, but I agree with you that it's difficult, especially under these facts.
Okay. Now let's put the 2008 standard back into the mix. How does that affect the standing inquiry? At least with respect to the Chicago and St. Louis redesignations. Milwaukee Racine is not...
Well, the Chicago and St. Louis are designated non-attainment with regard to the more stringent 2008 standard. So, you know, there was more regulation that's in place, would be in place to achieve that more stringent standard. So I don't see how this regulation would cause an injury to petitioners' members.
Well, what's the interplay between the 2008 standard and the non-attainment designations for Chicago and St. Louis and the 1997 standard that those areas were redesignated under?
Well, both standards are in place right now.
But my question is, how do they relate to each other?
The 2008 standard is more stringent because the limit is 0.075 parts per billion.
And what's the legal effect of that on the attainment redesignation in those two areas?
No, it's I think considered separately.
No legal effect.
The 97 standard was considered by itself in the context of this redesignation.
Have they met the 2008? It's non-attainment?
Your Honor, please repeat that.
The 2008 standards, what's the situation there?
Well, you have St. Louis and Chicago in non-attainment for 2008,
right.
and Milwaukee Racine is in attainment for 2008.
But on the 90, the earlier one, everybody has met that.
Well, yes. In the three decisions at issue, EPA redesignated the three areas for the 97 standard from non-attainment to attainment.
Is it part of an issue, getting back somewhat to Judge Sykes' question, who has to come forward with the facts, you or you produce them, or does the petitioner in this case have to come forward with the facts that as they relate to particular incidents that might affect the health of people?
Well, I think the Supreme Court says in the Clapper case that the burden is on the party seeking to establish jurisdiction. So in this case, it would be the petitioner who has the burden to come forward with facts establishing a particularized injury.
So do I understand? Do you have to win on the merits to get standing?
Well, I would say you don't have to reach the merits if they don't have standing.
But it's pretty close, isn't it? I mean,
well, there's overlap, obviously, but again, the showing was, in my view, really weak. They expressed a one-sentence concern about possible that they would ultimately be subject to worse air quality, and that ozone levels might go up. without really explaining how they would be injured, you know, just as a result of the redesignation decision. So it just isn't a sufficient showing to establish standing.
Well, the effect of the redesignation decision is to lift part of the regulatory regime, right?
Well, again,
so that the state can authorize expansions of source emitters and so forth.
Well, I don't know. I would say it changes the regulatory regime, but you have to remember the maintenance plan keeps all the permanent enforceable regulations in place.
Right, but permitting is relaxed.
I think there are different requirements, but I can't speak to specifics about that.
Seems to me, I don't know, just a little unusual for the EPA to be under attack for too lenient rather than the other way around.
Mm-hmm. Well, for doing what?
where you're seen as being not sufficiently stringent. That's a little odd. How often do these cases arise?
Well, I think Sierra Club files a lot of cases. You're right. Why don't I turn to the merits and the first issue regarding the whether EPA appropriately...
Well, let me back up. I didn't mean to be too facetious, but is this a, in general, across the board with regard to the EPA, is there are there a number of cases pending in which the same issue arises?
Well, I can say that EPA has been following the same redesignation analysis for two decades. Been doing things the same way with pretty good results. That is, few areas going from, then later going from attainment back to non-attainment. So they've had success. But I do know of another challenge in the Sixth Circuit that's pending at the moment regarding the Cincinnati area.
Thank you.
Turning to the merits, I think we should start with the statute that applies. It's Clean Air Act Section 107 D3E3, which requires that the EPA determine prior to redesignation that the improvement in air quality is due to permanent and enforceable reductions in emissions resulting from implementation of the state implementation plan and other federal regulations. And here, EPA made that determination as petitioner agrees. The issue here is what is the appropriate analysis? Now, I have to differ with petitioner's counsel. EPA was not ignoring things, these temporary factors that petitioner's counsel refers to, such as economic conditions and the weather and traffic. They weren't ignored. But the question is, does the statute, what sort of analysis does the statute require? The statutory language is broadly phrased to confer significant discretion on the agency to fashion an appropriate analysis in this context. And petitioner's argument would require, under the statute, EPA to account for all precursor reductions within the area, and then tally whether the reductions were caused by a permanent enforceable regulation or something else. And according to petitioner, that something else includes the traffic, the economy, or everything else affecting industrial activity. And that's from their reply brief. Everything else affecting industrial activity. And then after that, they think the statute requires EPA to take a second step, which is to focus only on those reductions, emission reductions coming from permanent and enforceable measures, focus only on those, and then determine from that ozone levels. And that, of course, would require EPA to factor in seasonal differences and the impact of sunlight, for example. Now, EPA, again, has been doing this analysis the same way for 20 years, and they don't do modeling because the statute doesn't require modeling.
What do they do?
They compare the actual emissions over a time period, 3-year time period, with a non-attainment year and an attainment year.
But what about underlying factors? Are they to be considered at all?
Yeah, if they're material. Now remember, this is a request that comes from the state, who makes a submission to EPA. The state didn't flag any other issues, and petitioner didn't provide any additional data on traffic or economy in their response, in their comments. So, all the statute requires is that EPA determine the improvement in air quality and that it's due to permanent enforceable reductions in emissions from these state implementation plan and other federal statutes. And that's exactly what EPA did.
What kind of group? I mean, you've got industrial that can cause the ozone, automobiles, power plants. Are they in particular categories that you look at, or are they all lumped together, or how do you?
Well, in the EPA's decisions, they summarize the different regulations that are permanent and enforceable and that resulted in the emissions in each of the geographic areas. Now, I think petitioner wants much more precision, a precision that would only be required by modeling. For example, you got to limit it to the 3 years, and you got to show how each of the emissions are due to one source or another or some other factor. But again, EPA explained how each of these regulations that affect motor vehicles or other stationary sources.
Part of my question that has to do with also, there's not been a relaxing of the regulation, but rather a tightening. For example, emissions with regard to automobiles or with regard to power plants or with regard to whatever.
Yes, and these new rules came into play during the comparison period of each of these redesignation decisions, and there was a downward trend from the 2002 to the 2008. So I think EPA fairly showed the causation between the reductions from these permanent and enforceable regulations and the air quality improvement.
What was its method for doing that in this case?
Well, they focused on actual emissions.
What provided the causal link?
You mean they for example, they tallied the actual emissions from major stationary sources, compared it between 2002 and 2008, identified that there had been controls put into place during that time period and that matched the downward trend of the emissions and reached its conclusion.
New controls?
Excuse me?
New controls that would have a cause and effect relationship?
I mean, some of the controls were put into place during these periods, yes.
What is the method for demonstrating cause and effect? Is it a reliance on effect?
Well, EPA didn't wake up and decide to do this. There are trends that they expect to see from the implementation of controls. The reduction in emissions of ozone precursors followed that, followed those trends. So, and again, there were no other.
So it's an assumption about causation.
I think it's more than that. I think they rely on their experience and expertise. I think it's much more than an assumption.
Has this method been validated by any appellate court? Or are we the first?
I don't know that the method has been validated by an appellate court.
It's just been used for a couple decades.
Well, yes. And I think, again, going back to the statute, it gives the agency significant discretion.
Sure.
And, you know, the court must defer to the agency with respect to its interpretation of a statute that Congress has charged it with enforcing. And, you know,
well,
deference...
if you had to put the agency's interpretation in a sentence or two, interpretation of this causation requirement that the administrator has to meet in order to redesignate, how would you put it? How would you describe it in just a couple sentences? What is the agency's interpretation?
Of the statute.
Right.
The agency has to determine that the gains in air quality were caused by...
That's just a restatement of what the legal requirement is. What's the agency's interpretation of that?
Well, I think... the interpretation is that it doesn't require more than a consideration of actual emissions between a non-attainment year and the attainment year, after considering state submission and all other relevant factors.
So proof of a drop in emissions is sufficient to establish causation? That's the agency's interpretation?
No, it's more than that. You look at the controls that were in place and the effect that they had on the reduction in emissions.
Effect is the key phrase there. How is that evaluated?
Well,
program, list the drop, done.
No, I don't think so. I think they find that they are connected, that one caused the
other.
No, they look at the data and see a correlation. Again, there was a downward trend in emissions between 2002 and 2008. A host of controls became effective during that time period. Not seeing any other significant factors that would explain that, you know, it's a reasonable conclusion to draw.
So there's a requirement that somebody come forward with other factors that might explain the reduction in order to undermine the assumption of causation? Is that...
No,
I don't know if I'm following this methodology, but that's how you're describing it.
Well, I don't think it's an assumption. I think it's a review of all the data, and the state makes a submission, which would include all other factors. EPA,
but who's pushing back against that submission, other than the Sierra Club?
Well,
is the agency pushing back against it?
Sure, it has to be an independent decision by EPA. But there's a submission and a request by the state.
How often are these denied?
Well, in this case, the Sheboygan proposal was deferred for the moment. So that's one example.
Once that decision has been made, that executive decision, does Chevron really shut down the appellate review? I mean, if there's a basis,
I think deference.
You know, I'm just trying to build on your statement, Serino, to Judge Sykes. Once the predicate facts as you lay them out before the decision is made, then is that really the end of the line for examination by the courts?
Well, I think if you see the way the statute is phrased, that it does give discretion to the agency.
No question.
And that this is an area of technical and scientific expertise that the agency has, you know, applied over time. I think there should be significant deference in this situation. So,
is there a standard between State Farm and the Chevron difference?
I think Chevron would apply for the interpretation of a statute, which is what we have here.
As opposed to State Farm, which would what?
I'm not familiar with the difference. I'd like to say a final word about the Knox SIP call. It's clearly a permanent enforceable measure that it was appropriate for the agency to rely on in its redesignation decision. Even if Well, that the NOx-CIP call has been in place since 1998, and it's another example of the agency's experience being able to understand how upwind controls impact downwind areas. So unless the court has further questions, I'll rely on the remainder of our brief.
Thank you, Mr. Rand.
If I may, I'd just like to make, I think, 5 points. The first has to do with deference. And with the agency's gets deference for its analysis, not for its conclusions. Right? I mean, the standard is that you look at its conclusion and look for a rational tie to the record. So that's our challenge here. Yes, they made the conclusion, but you know, where is the tie that establishes a causal link to these regulations?
Well, that's an application question. I'm in this particular set of redesignations. I'd like to talk more about the actual legal standard that the agency is applying. And I'm not sure I heard one from the government's lawyer. Maybe you know what it is. You're an expert in this area of the law. What is the interpretation that the agency is placing on this causation requirement?
I think you can find the agency's interpretation either in at Record 17, when it says what it thinks it needs to show here, or in the general preamble at page 57 of Fed Reg 13653. And what the agency says is that at least enough of an improvement to attain the standard in these areas has to be reasonably attributed to regulatory measures, to permanent and enforceable measures. And that the agency, and this is also in the Calsagni Memorandum, Record 86. And to do that, the agency has to distinguish temporary conditions such as adverse economic conditions. And again, this is 2008. These are remarkably adverse economic conditions from the effects of its regulations. And where it has regulations in place, and there is some difference between the amount that's allowed and the amount that's actually occurring, what the Calsagni Memorandum says is, well, look at the amount that's allowed, or provide something, some tangible evidence in the record.
Well, the agency said that that aspect of the, I'm not sure how to pronounce it, Calsagni?
I'm guessing.
Memo was superseded by a later administrator's memo, that they don't have to use the cap, they can use actual.
So, two things on that. First, the first time the agency said that was in its brief. If you look in the actual decisions, the agency cites for authority only to the Calsagni Memorandum. In each of these decisions, when it's discussing whether it can use actuals, it makes no reference to this Berry Memorandum. And then the second point is that if you look at the Berry Memorandum, it's talking about maintenance demonstrations. And again, under the 2004 Sierra Club decision, right, what that says is that the place where you figure out whether these measures are adequate to produce attainment is here, under subsection 3. It's in the redesignation requirements. You know, the maintenance demonstrations more or less assume that level's fixed. So that's held in place by regulation that things are just going to go down. So, you know, the maintenance provisions of the Act say nothing about whether measures need to be permanent and enforceable. And as EPA has applied it, they rely on this determination to ensure that they are permanent and enforceable. So I don't think that Berry memo really does anything to change this interpretation. And really, it couldn't. I mean, the statute says permanent and enforceable, right? So I'm not sure how EPA walks away from that with some kind of a memo that doesn't even address this part of the Act. On standing,
you may conclude on that point.
Okay. First, you know, there very clearly are these near-term effects on the requirements applicable to news sources. And there have been some new sources in these areas since redesignation. In Milwaukee, the Oak Creek plant has gone through this more relaxed new source review process. I'd be happy to give you some supplemental materials on that if it wasn't part of our brief. But it's happening. But more broadly, the only way this decision makes no difference is if the state never comes back and asks for redesignation under the 1997 standard. Right? I mean, if the court sends this back and says, we think you need to do more, right? The only way the state ever gets out of doing more is by never coming back. I mean, that is an extraordinarily unlikely probability given the structure of this statute. The whole structure of the Act, the whole point of the Act, is to get states to move from non-attainment to attainment and to provide them with an incentive to do so. If no other questions, right. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement. And